Brothers in the Dharma. Spring. The quick sap rises in the dry stalk. On naked boughs the furled green buds appear. Returning swallows beat about the clay-built house they left last year. Earth smiles, and like an almond tree, the bodhicitta flowers in me. This was a poem written by Bhante in 1962, and it's appropriate to read it now. It is, after all, springtime, at least the beginnings of springtime. But it's appropriate in another way, because it was in 1962 that Bhante received the Bodhisattva ordination from the Venerable Dado Rinpoche. That was on the 12th of October in Kalimpong. And Bhante said of the ordination that in Dado Rinpoche he'd found someone who he could revere as a living Bodhisattva. He had found, in other words, an ideal preceptor. An ideal preceptor for the Bodhisattva ordination. He also said that after the ceremony, Dado Rinpoche explained the 64 Bodhisattva precepts he'd just given to Bhante in considerable detail. So today, on the occasion of the 12th anniversary of Dado Rinpoche's death, it seems appropriate to have a little look at these Bodhisattva precepts. We won't have time to consider all of them, but we can look at the main ones. But before that, I want to say something about the Bodhisattva tradition that the Bodhisattva ordination which Dado Rinpoche gave to Bhante is part of. And of course, to understand this, we have to go back to the Mahayana tradition in India. You're all aware of that tradition, aware of the great sutras on which that tradition is based. Sutras like the White Lotus Sutra, the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, the Vimalakirti Nirdesha, the Sukhavati Sutras, and so on. But there are many other sutras as well, smaller sutras on all sorts of subjects, and some of them go into quite a bit of detail about the way a bodhisattva should behave. There's sutras which really deal with the precepts of a bodhisattva. There's the questions of Kashyapa, the questions of Upali, the questions of Surata, and so on. And a lot of these go into, in a lot of detail, the way in which a bodhisattva should behave. So what you actually find is there is a kind of bodhisattva vinaya, or bodhisattva pratimoksha. There's a kind of codification of ways of behaviour that go into the details of how someone who's dedicated to the Bodhisattva ideal should actually behave. And these sutras are very important, and they're highly influential on the Bodhisattva tradition. But perhaps even more influential are the works by the great acharyas, particularly Nagarjuna and Asanga early on, but also later teachers like Shantideva, Chandragomin, and Atisha, and others as well. All of them wrote not only great philosophical works, but works dealing with the way in which a bodhisattva should actually live. And all this material was, of course, transmitted to Tibet. A lot of it went to China as well, but let's just stay with Tibet. All this material was transmitted to Tibet. And of course, the Bodhisattva tradition became extremely important in the spiritual life of Tibetan Buddhists. It pervades Tibetan Buddhism very, very strongly. And eventually, the great teachers of Tibetan Buddhism of all schools, whether of the Gelug, Nyingma, Sakya, Kagyu, and all the sub-schools, discern two great traditions which describe the way in which a Bodhisattva should live. First of all, there's the tradition of the profound view. This tradition is regarded as having been inspired by the Bodhisattva Manjushri. It was transmitted by Manjushri, and was the kind of lineage goes Nagarjuna, Shantideva, and so on. And then you've got the tradition of extremely vast conduct. Lovely expression. The tradition of extremely vast conduct And this is inspired by the Bodhisattva Maitreya, who communicated this to Asanga, and then there's Vasubandhu, Chandragomin, Atisha. Particularly important in this tradition, for these traditions, or particularly important, particularly with the lineage of the profound, of extremely vast conduct, is the chapter on ethics from Asanga's Bodhisattva Bhumi. The Bodhisattva Bhumi is a huge work, was written in the 3rd or 4th century, dealing with all aspects of the Bodhisattva path. It means the stages of a Bodhisattva, Bodhisattva Bhumi. And the chapter on ethics is particularly important. Tsongkhapa wrote an important and influential commentary upon it, and that's the basis for all later Gelugpa commentaries. So there's a kind of lineage that comes down to us. There's the Buddha, the great Bodhisattvas, Asanga, or rather Nagarjuna, Asanga, Vasubandhu, Atisha, eventually Tsongkhapa, the Gelugpa school, Dado Rinpoche, Bhante. So there's a kind of lineage. Not, of course, that Bhante's given us the Bodhisattva ordination in the way he received it from Dado Rinpoche. We're part of, as it were, a lineage, but he hasn't transmitted the Bodhisattva ordination, and I don't expect he will. As you all know, Bhante has come to think of these things in a somewhat different way. But I think we can say, what we can definitely say, is that the Bodhisattva ordination is, in a sense, contained in the Dharmachari ordination that we take at the time of ordination. The arising of the bodhicitta, the altruistic dimension of going for refuge, is brought out explicitly in the verses of acceptance that come towards the end of the public ordination ceremony. Those verses of acceptance end with, "For the benefit of all beings, I accept this ordination. For the benefit of all beings, I accept this ordination." So it's quite clear that you're receiving the ordination, and the ordination is given in the spirit of gaining enlightenment for all living beings. The verse before, "For the benefit of all beings," is for the attainment of enlightenment, I accept this ordination. So we do accept ordination for the attainment of enlightenment for all beings. So the Bodhisattva ideal inspires our order, our movement. I don't think anybody would dispute that. Or it should do. It should inspire our order and our movement. If it doesn't, then we are not being true disciples of Urgyen Sangharakshita. We're not true disciples of Dado Rinpoche. Bhante himself speaks of, when he discovered the Bodhisattva ideal, of being thrilled, exhilarated, uplifted, and inspired by the Bodhisattva ideal. And Dado Rinpoche himself was deeply motivated by the Bodhisattva ideal. At the time of his enthronement, when he was brought from his Nyingma Pa monastery from his monastery on the borders with Tibet, when he was brought to Lhasa to the Gelug College where he would do his training, because I don't know if you realise this, Dado Rinpoche is an incarnation of a Nyingma Pa Tulku, but who was trained as a Gelug, so he's sort of thoroughly Gelug, but he has this kind of Nyingma affiliation as well, rather unusual. But he said, when he was being enthroned, and of course he was regarded as the incarnation of a very great Lama, somebody who was very close to the great 13th Dalai Lama, he was regarded, he was looked on, when he was taken to his enthronement, as a living Bodhisattva, as a Tulku. Tulku, I don't know if you realise this, translates the Sanskrit Nirmanakaya. But he was looked on as a living Bodhisattva. But he reflected, well, I don't feel that way, I don't feel like that, but if that's the way people regard me, then I will make myself into a Bodhisattva. I will live like that, I will become a Bodhisattva. And it's interesting, later on when he was talking to Subhadra and Moksha Priya and some other order members, he said very, very strongly, he said, what does it mean to be a Rinpoche? To be a Rinpoche means that you're a Bodhisattva. And he said, I've turned myself into a Rinpoche. I've become a Rinpoche. You too can become Rinpoches. You too can become Bodhisattvas if you live the Bodhisattva life. So he's obviously somebody deeply motivated by the Bodhisattva ideal. Recently, in order to understand the Bodhisattva tradition more, in order to live it better, Subhuti has been in the College of Public Preceptors, leading us through material associated with the Bodhisattva precepts that Dada Rinpoche gave to Bhante. We spent a week studying Bhante's translation of the 18 Mulapatis, or root or major downfalls,
we did that just the first 18. So these are the first 18 of what Bhante calls the Bodhisattva precepts, the 18 root downfalls from the Bodhicitta.
So Buddha's also taken us through some of Asanga's chapter on ethics with Tsongkhapa's commentary, which these precepts are taken from. And I believe in Tuscany and out in India, he's given lectures on Asanga's chapter on ethics from the Bodhisattva Bhumi. So this material is beginning to flow into the order. And I myself have found it very useful, very inspiring, but very, very useful indeed. And I've led study and given talks on aspects of this material on various retreats. I took the Mitra conveners through some of this material, which people found very useful. And I took some people I'd ordained through a text by Chandra Gomin, which was concerned with the same material. We've also studied it in the ordination team. And it does, I think everybody's found that it's all very useful, very stimulating, and it does give a new perspective on how to practice the Dharma. So this afternoon, I'm going to take a look at the first four of the 18 root downfalls from the Bodhicitta. The so-called, Bhante calls the 18 root downfalls and the 46 branch downfalls collectively the Bodhisattva precepts. But the more proper term is downfalls. Downfalls from the Bodhicitta. Downfalls from your Bodhisattva vow. And these first four downfalls sometimes occur as a set in their own right. So they're very important. In fact, the 46 minor downfalls are said to be different manifestations of the four root downfalls. I better not dwell on this too much, it gets too complicated. But anyway, the first four are regarded as a set in their own right. They're the basic, the most basic, the most fundamental ways in which we fall away from living the Bodhisattva life. And I want to look at these today so that we can discover ways in which we can live the Bodhisattva ideal more effectively. Usually on a day marking Dada Rinpoche, we have talks about his life, stories about him and so on. But this time I felt that we should look at some teachings that he would have known, that he would have been imbued with, he would have practiced, would have embodied. As Rinpoche told Subhadra, I became a Rinpoche, I became a Bodhisattva. You can do so as well. So it's good to know more about how we can do it. So the four Mulapatis, the four root downfalls in Bhante's translation are, first of all, it is a bad thing, they're all prefaced with it is a bad thing. It is a bad thing to praise oneself and disparage others. Secondly, it is a bad thing to withhold the wealth of the Dharma from others. Thirdly, it is a bad thing to punish and refuse to concede repentance. And fourthly, it is a bad thing to give up the Mahayana while still pretending to belong to it. So before looking at each of these individually, I want to say something about the root downfalls in general. First of all, looking at these Bodhisattva precepts, let's call them that, they really do seem to be addressed to people in positions
for the most part, for impositions of responsibility. That really does seem to be who they're addressed to, or certainly many of them are. Well, I think that's very relevant to all order members, and all people preparing for ordination, for that matter. All order members are in positions of responsibility. They're in positions of responsibility in relation to one another, and of course they're in positions of responsibility to those who aren't ordained, regardless of whether you have responsibility as a chairman or as a mitra convener or whatever it is. We are all in positions of responsibility. I think we do need to be very clear about that. I mean, people often feel it, don't they, when they're ordained, when they have the caser, when the caser goes on and their name is given and they turn up at the beginner's class or they go back to their centre, suddenly they realise the responsibility they have just by virtue of being an order member. It's said by Tsongkhapa and other commentators that these four root downfalls correspond to what is known as the four defeats of a bhikshu. This is interesting. And the four defeats of a bhikshu are sexual intercourse, murder, theft, and making claims about attainments you don't have. If you're a bhikshu and you do any of these, you're expelled from the monastic order and you cannot be ordained as a monk again in this lifetime. You've really blown it. And you notice that the four root downfalls are pitched at a different level, really, from the root downfalls in the Bodhisattva tradition. The root downfalls in the Bodhisattva tradition are downfalls, I think, or rather are falling away from a much higher level of practice. You fall away from the Bodhisattva vow, from the bodhicitta, not through having sex, you'll be relieved to hear, for example, but through praising yourself and disparaging others. You fall away not through stealing, although that would be a falling away, but you fall away but through withholding the wealth of the Dharma. You fall away not because of murder, though it's not saying you should murder people, but you fall away through punishing and not conceding repentance. And you fall away not through making claims about attainments that you don't have, but through pretending you are a follower of the Mahayana. So there are much more. It's a much more subtle level of practice that we're dealing with these bodhisattva downfalls. And also you can see that the four root downfalls are for everybody, for monks or lay people. They're not referring to a particular ecclesiastical status. You know, a monk having sex, well, of course, he ceases to be a monk because he's no longer celibate. So, as I've said, the Mahayana precepts are pitched at a different level. And it reminds me of a teaching that Bhante passed on from Mr. Chen. Mr. Chen once likened ethical observance in the three yanas to three different kinds of bowls. So Hinayana observance is like a clay bowl. Break the rule, well, it cannot be mended. So the four defeats are like this. It's like a clay bowl that's been broken. You can't do anything about it. They're smashed, that's it. Your monastic status is finished, it's gone. But in the Mahayana, it's more like the ethics in the Mahayana of the Bodhisattva is like having a brass bowl. You will dent the bowl. You will dent it. Because you're trying to do something that's very difficult. So you'll dent it. You will fall away in different ways from the Bodhisattva precepts. Because they're much harder to practice. But you can't break the bowl. You can only dent it. But then you have to kind of bash it back into shape. The Vajrayana, it said, Mr. Chen said, is like a crystal bowl. You can't break the bowl. You cannot break it because there's been no precept to take in the first place. I think you can sort of forget the Triyana way of looking at it. I think, in a way, it's just describing different levels of ethical practice. As we go on, our standards get higher. Our standards change. We expect more of ourselves. A bodhisattva expects more of himself. There's a kind of constant upgrading of ethical, spiritual, and spiritual practice. until the realization, as it's put in one Mahayana Sutra, of that all dharmas are vinaya. All dharmas are vinaya. All things are the ethical code. That means that you're then totally in tune with the way things are. Of course, that's the morality, if you can call it morality, of a Buddha. He's naturally ethical. His ethics are indestructible. And in a sense, then it's in a way you don't have ethics anymore then. So let's now have a look at these four root downfalls. Or as Bhante calls them, the first four of the Bodhisattva precepts which he received from the Venerable Dharado Rinpoche. So first of all, it is a bad thing to praise oneself and disparage others. This would seem to be really the most basic of all the downfalls, the most serious of ways we can fall away from the bodhicitta, from striving to gain enlightenment for all living beings. Obviously there are different levels to it, from very gross levels to very subtle levels. But if we praise ourselves and disparage others, what are we doing? We're giving expression to rank egotism and competitiveness. We're expressing a fundamental lack of empathy and sympathy with other people. It could be, as I've said, very gross, the expression of ambition and the desire for position. It could be something like that. Indeed, the Bodhisattva Bhumi describes it as with a longing for gain and respect to praise oneself and deprecate another. With a longing for gain and respect to praise oneself and deprecate another. And this downfall is also described as self-vaunting. You promote yourself by reviling others. You pump yourself up to push others down. You push others down to pump yourself up. And I notice it particularly when gossip goes on, when I do gossip. You know what it's like, getting together with friends and you start talking about others not present. And you start speaking about the people not present critically. And it makes you feel good, it makes you feel secure, it kind of boosts your self-confidence. Doesn't really, of course, but that's the way it can feel. You know, it can feel, well, we're all right. I remember one friend of mine used to pick us both up on this. We'd be talking about somebody not present in a critical way, and he'd say, but we're all right, aren't we? And it was like he was just blowing the whistle to say, come on, let's stop doing this. But there's more subtle forms of it. I think it can occur when we don't give due weight to the good that others have done. We might get a lot of praise for something or something like that. But actually, a number of other people might have been involved in the project, and we don't give them their due. We don't point that out to other people. I think what this downfall represents is really a falling away from interconnectedness. Interconnectedness. The bodhicitta, the bodhisattva vow, they're expressions, they're a kind of vision, an experience even, of interconnectedness with all beings, especially all other human beings. To then go around pumping yourself up in relation to others, to compete with others and try and gain respect by doing others down, is a turning away from interconnectedness, a turning away from the basic bodhisattva emotion, which is anukampa, which literally means to shake with, something like sympathy, empathy. It's often translated as compassion. Compassion itself, I believe, etymologically means simply to feel with. So we're falling away from that basic sense, that basic sympathy, that basic shaking with other people, that basic sense of solidarity with others. It would also be a falling away from the kind of observance of the first precept that Bhante has enjoined upon order members. It's very interesting, this is just an aside by the way, that I was looking through some Padmasambhava texts recently on the Bodhisattva tradition, on the arising of the Bodhicitta, and then he described the precepts that somebody who's trying to develop the bodhicitta observes. And they were the 10 precepts, the 10 precepts that we observe. So that was very interesting. I believe there's a Chinese, or rather a Japanese tradition, the Tendai tradition, that give the 10 precepts that we observe as the expression of the Bodhisattva's vow. But anyway, in the 10 pillars of Buddhism, Bhante speaks of observance of the first precept in terms of the cultivation of a profound imaginative identification with others. In fact, to illustrate this, he refers to Shantideva's teaching of Paratma Samatha, the realization of the sameness of self and other, even the Paratma Parivartana, the realization of the transference of self and other. But just to stay with the Paratma Samatha, the sameness of self and other, Shantideva puts it like this: when happiness is liked by me and others equally, what is so special about me that I strive after happiness myself? When fear and suffering are disliked by me and others equally, what is so special about me that I protect myself and not another? So this is the fundamental Bodhisattva attitude, realizing that everybody wants to be happy and wants to avoid suffering. The realization that we're not that special when it comes down to it, that we're all profoundly the same. This is also said to be the basis for the cultivation of metta, realizing that others are essentially the same as us. They want to be happy, they're trying to be happy. They might be trying to be happy in the weirdest of ways, but that's the fundamental motivation. Dada Rinpoche, of course, was someone who realized the sameness of self and others. In the book Dada Rinpoche, A Celebration, which I would warmly recommend, there's some wonderful stories which illustrate this, especially, I think, from his Tibetan disciples. Jigme Wangchuk Khaldun, the second son of Jampal Khaldun, said, Rinpoche used to say that if you have 1 rupee and buy something for yourself and enjoy it all alone, after 5 minutes it's gone. If you divide the rupee into 2, you can share it between 2 people, and if into 4, then between 4 people, and that's a greater happiness. He said that the happiness and peace of mind you get from seeing the happiness of those you have shared with is greater than the happiness of taking for ourselves alone. So this little teaching of Rinpoche shows the expression of the realization of sameness in terms of generosity. So this brings us to the second of the root downfalls. It is a bad thing to withhold the wealth of the Dharma from others. All of us have had the great good fortune of having received the wealth of the Dharma. In so many ways, the Dharma has been given to us and continues to be given to us. There's Bhante's numerous lectures, seminars, personal communications, books, and so on and so forth. So much he's transmitted. There's a wealth of teachings and practices that we can take up. Teachings and practices that we can actually use. And the wealth has come to us and continues to come to us in other ways. Order members give talks, we go on retreats, we recipients of Kalyana Mitratar. On this retreat itself, Subhuti is giving a number of talks all about, I don't know what they're on actually, but there must be something to do with the order. We also have, you know, the wealth of the Dharma continues to be communicated, and yes, we're part of the communication of that wealth. Then there's facilities. We're recipients of the wealth of the Dharma with extraordinary facilities. You know, we provide these facilities for one another. It's worth reflecting on. Well, we can have a large chapter convenience retreat because we've got a big retreat centre in which to do it. We really are very rich and very wealthy with the Dharma in so many ways. I think it's well worth pausing and reflecting on how much is actually available to us. Our teacher, Bhante, cannot be described as having the Acharya Mutti, as it's called, the tight fist of a bad teacher who holds things back. And within the Mahayana, there's much emphasis on taking the Dharma out to people, making it available, making teachings and practices available, befriending people, providing facilities for them. There's much emphasis, by the way, on the providing of facilities to people. That the Bodhisattva, there's all sorts of different lists of ethics that a Bodhisattva takes up, but many of them cover providing people with the facilities for practice. There's one set of ethics, is the ethics of gathering a crowd. What it means is, it's like the Sangravastis, creating a community, but a part of the ethics in that includes providing the facilities for practice. Well, we're all trying to do that collectively. So this is another very basic downfall. There is the Bodhisattva vow, the vow to liberate all beings. At ordination, we accepted our ordination for the benefit of all beings. But what would that mean if we then withhold the Dharma? If we don't give out of the wealth of the Dharma that we have, we're going against what we dedicated our lives to. So why would we withhold the wealth of the Dharma? First of all, I think it's because we don't realise that we possess it in the first place. And we don't recognise what we actually have. I think it's well worth not just pausing to reflect on what we have, but kind of looking around the world. You know, like, it's good to look at a map of the world. We do this at the end of the Gukhya Loka course. We put a big map of the world up, and then we just show where the FWBO centres are. Even if you were to add all the other Buddhist centres that were in the world, you'd still have these vast spaces where, as far as we know, there's no Dharma. There's no Dharma being taught. And when you actually stand back and look at the world, and you look at the forces that are kind of going on in the world, well, our little centres, and they are little centres when you compare it with what's going on in the world, really are flickering little lamps of Dharma. I often invoke this image of you know, little lamps flickering in, you know, in a lot of very heavy winds. You know, we can look at ourselves and we can be either indifferent or overcritical about it all. But in comparison to the strife, the lack of meaning, the ugliness of the world, we're in possession of something extraordinary. We really are in possession of something extraordinary. But, you know, because we don't realise it, we don't pass it on. We don't make it available. I sometimes reflect on this in relation to the whole issue of harmony. I know some people think that there's a lot of disharmony in the order. Some people kind of claim that. Recently in Shabda there's been things on that. But actually, if you compare the world and the disharmony and the strife in the world, I think the degree of harmony compared, you know, when you think of how spread out the order is absolutely remarkable. It's an incredible degree of harmony. So we often don't realise this. We don't often realise what we've got in comparison to the world. So that can make us, you know, not want to or forget about giving the Dharma to others, giving the Sangha to others for that matter. And I think related to this is lack of confidence. We can think that we don't have much to offer personally. We've got an enormous amount to offer personally. I always used to notice this on the Kalyana Mitra retreats that we did, especially the early ones where we did these retreats for order members to look at the whole issue of becoming Kalyana Mitras. And the main issue, I think, why people were holding back on becoming Kalyana Mitras was because they weren't confident. They didn't realise how much they personally had to offer, because they were going for refuge to the Three Jewels, because they were practicing, they had a lot to offer, but they just didn't realise it. So we can withhold the wealth of the Dharma because of lack of confidence. We can also withhold the wealth of the Dharma through laziness. Simple as that. We might not want to put up with personal discomfort. giving the Dharma can might mean that we have to put ourselves out. It can be very tiring communicating the Dharma. If you take on doing lots of classes, giving talks, taking retreats, seeing people, spending time with people, well, yes, it's a responsibility. It does make you a bit tired sometimes. It can be really difficult in some parts of the world. If you're trying to communicate the Dharma in India, for example, it can really cause you a lot of hardship, as we know. But I always feel that if that's influencing me, it's laziness on my part. If a little bit of hardship is preventing me from going out of my way to communicate the Dharma, it's simply laziness. It's nothing else. Sometimes we might withhold the wealth of the Dharma out of fear. We might not speak out in certain situations because we're worried about being criticised. Maybe we don't go to certain places. Years ago, Bhante saying that, I don't know how practical this is, but he thought that he was saying to order members, well, why don't you try and teach the Dharma in working men's clubs, or, you know, go to factories and places like that, you know, really sort of take people on. Well, I'd certainly think twice, thrice, loads of times before I did anything like that, because I'd be frightened. It's as simple as that. Sometimes it can be even within our own Sangha. You know, somebody can be behaving in a certain way or saying certain things, and you believe, well, this is not the truth. This is not the way things are, and you don't speak. You withhold the wealth of the Dharma. You withhold the wealth of the truth. So we can withhold the wealth of the Dharma through fear. Giving the wealth of the Dharma means, of course, having it, possessing it, which means knowing the Dharma in breadth and depth. It means, therefore, that we have to plunge into the Dharma, study the Dharma, reflect upon the Dharma, meditate upon the Dharma, so that we're rich with Dharma. The Bodhisattva Bhumi actually describes this downfall in another way. It says, while the goods exist in his, the Bodhisattva's possession, to cold-heartedly fail to donate material things and not to teach the Dharma out of stinginess. So it's not just withholding the Dharma, it's withholding wealth. It's talking about generosity with material things and with the Dharma. Dada Rinpoche was an exemplar of both of these things. Mr. Tashi Dorje, who's a teacher at the ITBCI, said, many Rinpoches came from Tibet. Many of the big Rinpoches would only respond to those who were wealthy or powerful. But our Rinpoche was ready to go anywhere. There was a place called Bang Lang where the beggars slept. Whenever one of the beggars was sick or died, Rinpoche would go. He wasn't concerned for himself. He cared for the common people. That's why he established our school. This is an oft-repeated theme in these interviews that Mahamati did with Rinpoche's Tibetan disciples. That Rinpoche would go anywhere, he'd go to anybody to give the wealth of the Dharma, without regard for personal hardship, without regard about how people treated him. You know, there was another person described going on tour with Rinpoche to these areas where very, very poor Tibetans, uneducated, uncultured Tibetans lived, mostly followers of kind of Nyingma tradition. And Rinpoche just didn't bother about any kind of sectarian stuff. He'd join in with them, join in with their chanting, and these people would drink and, you know, they were a bit rough and ready. It didn't matter. Rinpoche communicated to them, communicated the Dharma to them, and he wasn't bothered in any way about personal hardship. He'd give so much in terms of material things as well. There's so many stories of him giving money to children, to beggars, day in and day out. Incredible, these stories. Thirdly, it is a bad thing to punish and refuse to concede repentance. Another translation of this downfall describes this as not accepting an apology and holding a grudge. And the Bodhisattva Bhumi speaks of it in terms of anger and using harsh words and even striking others. So obviously there's a number of areas covered by this downfall. First of all, it addresses the whole issue of anger and retaliation. And these unskillful states, anger and retaliation, are regarded as the very worst thing a bodhisattva can do. Mahayana sutras even go so far as to say that greed is not so bad, we're all relieved to hear. Because at least with greed, you're not cutting off from others. You're not cutting yourselves off from others. But anger for a bodhisattva is terribly serious. Because when he gets angry, the bodhisattva cuts himself off from others. This was really brought home to me many years ago in India by an order member named Amoghaditya. I lived with Amoghaditya for a number of years in Bombay. And I was kind of a Kalyana Mitra to him. So I had a lot of contact with him before he was ordained and just after he was ordained. And one of the things that used to do in India, I did used to lose my temper. I used to get angry, and I can remember on retreat one time with Amoghaditya and other order members, I think it was a Mitra retreat, in the chapter meeting I lost my temper about something. Something hadn't been done to my satisfaction, so I started to shout and, you know, say harsh things. Anyway, the next day at lunch I was sitting next to Amoghaditya and he said to me, "You shouldn't be like that, Padmavajra." Now, he didn't know much English, but he knew enough to make his point. And his name means unobstructed son, and he is an unobstructed son. He just kept saying it, "You shouldn't do that, Padmavajra, you shouldn't be like that." And I said, "Well, people shouldn't behave, blah, blah, blah." He said, "No, you shouldn't do that, Padmavajra, you shouldn't be like that." And then he said, "You shouldn't be like that because you're a good person and you can benefit people. But if you get angry, people stay away from you and you can't benefit them then." And well, what do you say to that? I mean, I was speechless. I tried to speak, but I could even barely finish my meal. It was such a strong thing to say because, well, he was saying I was a good person. He was rejoicing in my merits, but he said, "You're doing something which spoils that, which keeps people away from you. People are afraid to come to you. They don't want to, you know, they don't want to be treated like that." So that was a real teaching. And I've certainly never forgotten it. Whether I've been any good at practicing it, I don't know. I think I've got better than I was when I was in India in those days. But it was a really good teaching. Any of us here, but especially order members, especially senior order members, especially Kalyana Mitras, especially preceptors, have to be very, very careful with this one. Very, very careful. We have to be very careful not to behave in a way that alienates people from us, because we're cutting people off from the Dharma. That's what's going on if we get angry. But this downfall is addressing more than anger and retaliation. It's addressing the whole issue of holding a grudge, holding on to resentment, and not accepting other people's apologies. It's addressing the whole business of wanting to blame others. Blame others for our unhappiness. Blame others for things going wrong. These emotions are particularly destructive of human society, and they're very destructive of spiritual community. And of course, we live in an age, it seems to me, where there is just so much complaint and so much blame. We live in a time where, well, you can go to court to have all your blame, made money out of. And we certainly, I think, need to resist that this kind of culture of blame, I think, in our Sangha, and to develop the great spiritual quality of forgiveness, the great spiritual act of forgiveness. Yes, we can feel wronged by others. Sometimes, objectively, we may have been wronged by others. Maybe other people have treated us badly, even very badly, or just thoughtlessly. Sometimes, of course, we imagine that we've been wronged by others. This is what happens. The thing is, either way, whether a real wrong has been done or whether it's an imagined wrong, Buddhist tradition, all Buddhist traditions, are adamant that there is never any justification for retaliation, resentment, grudge holding, and blaming. Never, ever any justification for it. I think I've been thinking about this quite a lot, and we talked quite a lot about it when we studied this material. And I was trying to look at myself when I feel wronged by somebody, whether it's a real or imagined slight. I suppose it goes something like this. I feel made small. I feel humiliated. I feel in a way that my existence has been denied. And, you know, the world therefore goes wrong. It's out of alignment. It's not right. There's something's gone wrong with the universe because I've been made small. I've been denied. And I want to win back the sense of myself, my self-confidence, I suppose, or the kind of balance in the universe. And I think I can win it back. I can bring back my feeling of dignity by attacking the other person, by blaming them, by bringing them down, even demanding that they apologise, humiliate back, I suppose. This is an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth morality, isn't it? But of course, it never happens like that. I know whenever I've, you know, gone back at somebody, I never feel satisfied. I never ever feel satisfied. I always feel even more frustrated. It's impossible to kind of win back that sense of harmony through retaliation. There is a frustration, an inherent frustration in anger. We think that if we got it out, the frustration would go, but I just don't believe it. I think the frustration just goes on. There's a dukkha in anger. Shanti Deva says, there is no way that an angry man can be happy. There is no way that an angry man can be happy. I think that, this brings us to the practice of forgiveness, which I think is a lecture in itself. It would be good to have even a series of lectures in it. But I think if we want to practice it, I think we need to perhaps go through a number of stages. First of all, have they done anything wrong? We can be so convinced that somebody's done something wrong. I had an exchange with Padmataka a few weeks ago, and I was convinced he'd said something to wrong me. Absolutely convinced. And of course he hadn't. It was just one of those misunderstandings. And I sort of wanted him to have wronged me so I could get him back. It was really perverse. But have we actually been wronged? Is it just a misunderstanding? Have we misconstrued what's been said? If they have, then we have to develop understanding. I don't know if you remember in the Sutra of Golden Light, in the section on confession, we confess all the faults that we've done through the oppressions, all the different oppressions, the oppressions of existence, the oppressions of time, the oppressions of the arrival of an evil friend, and so on and so forth. It's as if life, there are so many kind of pressures in life. Yes, we will be unskillful. And yes, you confess that. You take responsibility for that unskillfulness. But in relation to other people, we try to understand. They've done that because of all sorts of conditions, all sorts of pressures upon them. And if we can understand them, we can let go of the anger. We can forgive. We can develop sympathy. So understanding. And then thirdly, I think really, in the end, to be able to forgive, to always to forgive whenever anything happens, I think we need insight. Is it to err is human, to forgive is divine, I think Alexander Pope said. Well, I think it's not just divine, it's transcendental. I think we really learn to forgive when we recognise, well, we've been born into an imperfect, a very imperfect world. And it's a world where these things happen. It's in the nature of things. And we say that not in a cussed way, not in a, well, it happens, doesn't it? You know, they are like that. Not like that. But, well, this is the nature of samsara. Samsara doesn't conform to our desires. It doesn't even conform to our spiritual aspirations. I was turned onto this particular point when I was reading a book by John Middleton Murray called Keats and Shakespeare, which is a wonderful book. But in discussing Keats's negative capability, his famous doctrine, I suppose you could call it, of negative capability, he talks about forgiveness. And Middleton Murray kind of comments on a saying of Chekhov, "And all things are forgiven, and it would be strange not to forgive." And Murray says, he talks about a forgiveness which forgives not only men, but life itself. Not only the pains which men inflict, but the pains which are knit up in the very nature of existence. He also says, "We have no word for this. We've scarcely even a sense of the quality itself. Let it be called, though the word cannot fail to be misunderstood, acceptance," capital A. "And all things are forgiven, and it would be strange not to forgive." So that's what we have to kind of aim for. Like I say, even our spirit, the world doesn't conform to our spiritual aspirations. We put, as aspiring bodhisattvas, as novice bodhisattvas, you know, we throw ourselves into things, you know, into building centres, running centres, spending time with people, being a Kalyana Mitra. We put loads into our chapter, loads into our community. And then, you know, people seem to sort of let us down. They don't seem to be interested, or they might be rude to us, or whatever it might be, or, you know, the sorts of things that happen. But we carry on. We can forgive it all because we know, well, this is what happens. This is the nature of things. So a bodhisattva is this strange creature, this strange being who works tirelessly for others, fully engages with them, emotionally engages with them, builds a sangha, spreads the dharma, is profoundly emotionally involved, but he knows the fragility of it all at the same time. So he can let go, he can forgive. It's an extraordinary quality. It must be an extraordinary being, a bodhisattva, to be like that. Incredibly emotionally involved, but understanding, well, just the nature of how it could go, how it could turn out. I remember being very struck, almost shocked, when I saw an interview with the Dalai Lama when he first came to England. And this is before I'd become a Buddhist. And he was asked about his attitude to Mao, to Chairman Mao. And the Dalai Lama just said straight out, "He is my greatest friend. He is my greatest friend." And the interviewer was shocked. And he said, "He is my greatest friend because he teaches me patience. He teaches me forgiveness." What a thing to say. And this, of course, is his classic Shantideva teaching, isn't it? I've been thinking as well that I think forgiveness is when compassion is mostly itself. I was very struck by this in doing the Vajrasattva sadhana intensively on a solitary retreat. And in that sadhana, you purify yourself of all your evil through visualising Vajrasattva above your head. He purifies you and all beings. That's what you imagine anyway. And then towards the end of the practice, you confess to him and he forgives you. He says, "My son, from today, all your sins, as well as all those of other people, are wiped out." And it seemed to me at that time that was the kind of heart of the practice, the essence of the practice, that I was sort of seeing, getting a glimpse of compassion at its most pure, its most quintessential. Yes, compassion as being fully itself when it forgives. But in the face of evil, in the face of bad things being done to you, compassion forgives. Incredibly, incredible thing. So, yes, forgiveness is when compassion is mostly itself. Of course, we just have to begin all this process by just letting go of the little hurts, real or imagined. You just let them go. You don't make a big song and dance about them. You know, somebody doesn't bring you tea, somebody doesn't say the right word, somebody forget something, you don't make it into a song and dance. You just let it go. You just let it go. Dada Rinpoche was naturally forgiving. He was a very compassionate man. But people said that he always did what was right, what he thought was right. He always acted in accordance with the Dharma. And if that meant criticising others, being outspoken, he did so. And he was particularly outspoken to the Tibetan aristocracy and to the vested interests of the Tibetan government in exile. The Tibetan government in Tibet when he was in Tibet. And this annoyed and angered many people. And apparently Tibetan government officials in particular treated him extremely badly in all sorts of ways, including preventing him from seeing the Dalai Lama. There's even a story, but apparently Dalai Rinpoche was never ever angered by this. He was always forgiving. He never returned it. There's even a story about a man who treated Rinpoche very badly in Kalimpong. Was always harming Rinpoche and his work. But when he died, Rinpoche went to him and immediately performed the man's death ceremonies. There was no hesitation. There was no, he treated me badly, so I don't want anything to do with him. So fourthly, the fourth downfall, it is a bad thing to give up the Mahayana while still pretending to belong to it. So here we have a kind of false, a counterfeit practice of the Bodhisattva path. We might talk all about compassion and caring and helping others, but it finds no expression in actual deeds. Mantis comments are interesting here about Mahayana Buddhists he'd met, who were kind of, their allegiance was to the Mahayana. He met Tibetan lamas who, could expound on the Bodhisattva path, on the Bodhisattva ideal. But they were doing nothing, or very little, to put it into practice. But it's true for us, of course. We can use the language, as I've been doing in this talk, we can use the language of caring and sympathy. It's very much the language of our times. Care, sympathy, especially in spiritual circles. And people can be very earnest, but it's so easy to be sentimental. We have all the language, all the patter. We can even have the look of the caring, sharing person. But actually, live a thoroughly self-centered life. A bodhisattva is not like this. He not only talks about compassion, he actually lives it, he practices it, he does it. There are other interpretations of this downfall, and one of them says that it means rejecting the Mahayana sutras, being choosy about them. It says you should accept the sutras in their totality. So I think the point being made here is, you'll like the teachings on Shunyata and Buddha nature, but you don't really want to look at sutras that deal with renunciation, for example. The Bodhisattva accepts the totality of teachings. Another interpretation is that one devotes oneself to counterfeits of the Dharma and teaches those counterfeits to others. And I remember years ago Bhante being particularly concerned about this. He read that article by an American Buddhist teacher who talked about the need for Buddhism to be democratized, feminized, was it domesticated or integrated? And he wrote that very strong article called The Idols of the Marketplace. He thought that was a complete misrepresentation of Buddhism. The Dharma is always in danger of being hijacked by the false views of the age. But a bodhisattva doesn't allow himself to be hijacked. He's rooted in the Dharma and able to communicate the Dharma in his time and in his place and without compromise. And of course Dalai Rinpoche was a great example of this. He lived the bodhisattva path. He lived the Mahayana, the great way, the great vehicle, the vehicle that carries all to Buddhahood. Dalai Rinpoche, A Celebration, that book, is just full of stories of his compassionate response, his care for others, his practical care for others. Some of these stories are very, very touching. The sorts of ways he personally cared for the children in his school, actually doing things for them of all kinds. And reading these stories, I just couldn't help but be reminded of Shantideva's lines, his description of a bodhisattva as being a protector for those without protection, a guide for those who wander. And Rinpoche was totally rooted in the Dharma of all schools and all traditions. And he was very concerned that it should be practiced properly. And he was completely non-sectarian in his approach to the Dharma. He told me that he'd studied the school, all the schools of Tibetan Buddhism very deeply and had come to the conclusion that there was no essential difference between any of them. He was generous and principled. Jampo Kalden, in his piece in the book Dada Rinpoche's Celebration, always insisted when he gave an initiation that the initiation must be practiced. You must practice the sadhana associated with the initiation. And Jampo Kalden, for this reason, only took one or two initiations from Dada Rinpoche. And when great Tibetan lamas came to Kalimpong, unlike the other Tibetans, he wouldn't go and take initiation from them because of Rinpoche's concern that the Dharma should be practiced properly, that everything should be done properly. So, hearing this, I've used the four downfalls in the end to talk about Dada Rinpoche. I've told a few stories about him, but no wonder Bhante felt he could revere Rinpoche as a living bodhisattva. And read that book, Dada Rinpoche, A Celebration, and Suvadra's book. You can really see why Bhante felt he could revere Rinpoche as a living bodhisattva. Bhante would have seen, when he lived in Kalimpong, Rinpoche's continuous, uninterrupted love and compassion, his constant awareness and wisdom. He would have seen it not just in his teaching of the Dharma, but in his deeds, in the way he lived. And no wonder Bhante wanted to take the Bodhisattva ordination from Dada Rinpoche. And we're also fortunate, we're also blessed to have this connection to Rinpoche through Bhante. And we're especially blessed here at Padmaloka to have a portion of the relics of Dada Rinpoche. I'm so grateful to Bhante for enshrining the relics here and, giving us the relics, if you like, and enshrining the relics in our stupa. And at Padmaloka, we all feel a deep and strong connection with Rinpoche. We feel that he's present in some way. A couple of years ago, Jampal and Mrs. Kalden came here for a visit, and that was a wonderful event, and it really did seem to seal the connection with us and Rinpoche and his disciples, and watching them worship the stupa. And sometimes it's almost as if he's teaching us. And the other day we had a teaching from him. It was a particularly dramatic teaching. There were some very high winds a few weeks ago, and we tied flags to the top of the stupa, as we often do, but we hadn't taken them down. And the winds were so strong that they pulled off the top, the whole of the top of the spire off the stupa. It went crashing down and broke rather dramatically, and we were all very upset and very disturbed by it. But I was reflecting on this later, and I can remember something that Bhante said about Rinpoche, that he talked about Rinpoche's mindfulness. He said this mindfulness, this awareness that was kind of uncanny, magical. Do you remember the story that he told about how they ended up at Bodh Gaya on that tour that Bhante and Rinpoche and the prominent Buddhists from border areas undertook? They didn't know they were going to Bodh Gaya. They thought they were going to a cement works. But they were, the organisation that can sometimes happen in India. They ended up at Bodh Gaya and they had no offerings. There was no, in those days, there were no stalls where you could buy offerings. Bodh Gaya wasn't organised like that in those days. So there they are, these prominent Buddhists from border areas with nothing to offer to the Bodhi tree. And Bhante looked at Dada Rinpoche and saw him pulling out from his voluminous Tibetan robes enough candles and incense for everybody to make an offering. So Bhante said he had this kind of mindfulness that just kind of looked ahead. Well, the teaching for us was we weren't aware. We weren't looking ahead. If we'd stopped and looked, we would have realised that flags, heavy winds equals stupa being broken. So we got a teaching, and it was a great shock to us, and we take it as a teaching from Rinpoche to be more mindful, to be more aware and to look ahead. If we're going to be bodhisattvas, we really do need to have that quality of awareness. If we never want to fall away from the aspiration to attain enlightenment for the benefit of all beings, we will need not only constant kindness and compassion, but constant awareness, mindfulness and vigilance. By the way, I'm pleased to say that somebody else did have the mindfulness that looks ahead. Rod Drew, who made the stupa, had actually hidden at Padmaloka lumps of stone from the original stone just for this eventuality. So Rod Drew's got a bit of that mindfulness. Take note, people from who know him. Especially when you're discussing his ordination request. The stupa of Dada Rinpoche is a constant reminder of the qualities of a great bodhisattva. When we worship that stupa, as we will be doing later on, we do so not only to express our reverence and devotion, we do so also in order to develop the qualities that Rinpoche demonstrated, the qualities, his qualities, in our own lives, the wondrous qualities of the bodhisattva. May we all, inspired by Dada Rinpoche, devote ourselves to the development, to the cultivation of the bodhicitta, and to following the endless path of the bodhisattva. Thank you.